One day, Maya crashed her fist against the table and cried, "Couldn't we wait for the island ridge to get torn away?" After an awkward pause, Kasei said, "It's 100 kilometers long." "Well, shit! Couldn't we just wait until this flood stops? I mean, how long can it go on like this?"
"A few months," Anne said.
"Can't we wait that long?"
"We're running low on food," Michelle explained.
"We have to keep going," Frank snapped at Maya. "Don't be stupid."
She glared at him and turned away, clearly furious. The rover suddenly seemed much too small, as if a bunch of tigers and lions had been thrown together in a dog's kennel. Simon and Kasei, oppressed by the tension, suited up and went out to scout what lay ahead. Beyond what they called Island Ridge, Caprades opened up like a funnel, with deep troughs under the diverging canyon walls. The northern trough was Capri Chasma, and the southern trough was Eos Chasma, which ran on as a continuation of Caprades. Because of the flood, they had no choice but to follow Eos, but Michelle said it was the way they would have wanted anyway. Here the southern cliff finally lowered a bit and was cut with deep embayments and shattered by a couple of good-sized meteor craters. Capri Chasma curved out of their sight to the northeast. Between the two trough canyons was a low, triangular mesa, now a peninsula dividing the course of the flood in two. Unfortunately, the great bulk of the water ran into the somewhat lower Eos, so that even though they were out of the tight constriction of Caprades, they were still pressed against a cliff and moving slowly, off any road or trail, and with diminishing supplies of food and gases. The cupboards were nearly bare. They were tired, very tired. It had been 23 days since they had escaped from Cairo, now 2,500 kilometers up canyon. And all that time they had been sleeping in shifts and driving almost constantly, and living in the aural assault of the flood, the roar of a world falling down in pieces on their heads. They were too old for this, as Maya said more than once, and nerves were frayed. They were fudging things, making little mistakes, falling into microbursts of sleep. The bench that was their road between cliff and flood became an immense boulder field, the boulders mostly ejecta from nearby craters or detritus from really extensive mass wasting. It looked to Anne like the big fluted and scalloped embayments in the southern cliff were sappings that would initiate tributary subsidence canyons. But she didn't have the time to look very closely. Often it seemed that they were going to have their way blocked entirely by boulders, that after all these days and kilometers, after negotiating most of Marineris in the midst of a most violent cataclysm, they were going to be halted just short of the tremendous washes leading out of its lower end. But then they found a way, and were stopped, and found a way, and were stopped, and found a way, and so on, for day after day after day. They went to half rations. Anne drove more than anyone else, as she seemed to be fresher than the rest, and was the best driver there anyway, with the possible exception of Michelle. And she felt she owed it to them after her shameful collapse during the greater part of their journey. She wanted to do everything she could, and when she wasn't driving, she went out to scout the way. It was still numbingly loud outside, and the ground trembled underfoot. It was impossible to get used to that, though she did her best to ignore it. Sunlight burned through the mist and haze in broad, lurid splashes, and in the sunset hour, ice bows and sun dogs appeared in the sky, along with rings of light around the dulled sun. Often the whole sky seemed afire, a Turner vision of the apocalypse. Soon enough, Anne too wore down, and the work became exhausting. She understood now why her companions had been so tired, why they had been so short with her and with each other. Michelle had been unable to locate the last 3 caches they had passed, buried or drowned. It didn't matter. The half rations were 1,200 calories a day, much less than they were expending. Lack of food, lack of sleep, and then, for Anne at least, the same old depression, persistent as death, rising in her like a flood, like a black slurry of mud, steam, ice, shit. Doggedly, she kept at the work, but her attention kept blinking out and the glossolalia kept returning, washing everything away in the white noise of despair. The way got harder. One day they made only a kilometer. The following day they seemed completely stopped, the boulders arrayed across the bench like tank stoppers in Big Man's Maginot Line. It was a perfect fractal plane, Sachs remarked, of about 2.7 dimensions. No one bothered to answer him. Cassay, wandering on foot, found a passage right down on the bank of the flood. For the moment, the whole visible expanse of the deluge was frozen, as it had been for the last couple of days. It stretched out to the horizon, a jumbled surface like Earth's Arctic Sea, only much dirtier, a great mix of black and red and white lumps. The ice just offshore was flat, however, and in many places clear. They could look down into it and see that it appeared to be only a couple of meters deep and frozen right down to the bottom. So they drove down to this icy shore and ran along it, and when rocks in the way forced her to, Anne put the left wheels of the rover out onto the ice and then the entire car, and it held like any other surface. Nadia and Maya snorted at the other's nervousness about this course. "We spent all winter driving on the rivers in Siberia," Nadia said. "They were the best roads we had." So for an entire day, Anne drove along the ragged edge of the flood and out onto its surface, and they made 160 kilometers, their best day in 2 weeks. Near sunset, it began to snow. The west wind poured out of Caprades, driving big, gritty clumps of snow past them as if they weren't moving at all. They came to a fresh slide zone, which spilled right out onto the ice of the flood. Big boulders scattered over the ice gave it the air of an abandoned neighborhood. The light was dusky gray. They needed a foot guide through this maze, and in an exhausted conference, Frank volunteered and went out to do the job. At this point, he was the only one of them with any strength left, more even than the younger Cassay. Still boiling with the heat of his anger, a breeder fuel that would never give out. Slowly he walked ahead of the car, testing routes and returning, either shaking his head or waving Anne on. Around them, thin veils of frost steam lofted into the falling snow, the two mixing and gusting off together on the powerful evening wind, off into the murk. Watching the dark spectacle of one hard gust, Anne misread the configuration of the ice's meeting with the ground, and the rover ran up onto a round rock right at the frozen shoreline, lifting the left rear wheel off the ground. Anne gunned the front wheels to roll them over the rock, but they dug into a patch of sand and snow, and suddenly both rear wheels were barely touching the ground, while the front two merely spun in the holes they had dug. She had run the rover aground. It had happened before several times, but she was annoyed with herself for getting distracted by the irrelevant spectacle of the sky. "What the fuck are you doing?" Frank shouted over the intercom. Anne jumped in her chair. She would never get used to Frank's biting vehemence. "Get going," he shouted. "I ran it onto a rock," she said. "Damn you! Why don't you watch where you're going? Here, stop the wheels. Stop them! I'm going to put the grip cloths under the front wheels and lever you forward, and then you get it off this rock and up the slope as quick as you can, understand? There's another surge coming." "Frank," Maya cried, "get inside. Soon as I get the fucking pads down, be ready to go." The pads were strips of spiked metal mesh set under wheels that had dug holes into sand and then pegged out ahead so that the wheels had something to grip. An ancient desert method. And Frank ran around the front of the rover, cursing under his breath and snapping directions to Anne, who obeyed with her teeth clenched and her stomach knotted. "Okay, go!" Frank shouted. "Go!" "Get in first," Anne cried. "There's no time! Go! It's almost here! I'll hang on the side! Go, damn it, go!" So Anne gently accelerated the front wheels and felt them catch on the grips and scrape the car forward over the rock until the rear wheels touched down again and they scraped off and were free. But the roar of the flood suddenly doubled and redoubled behind them, and then there were chunks of ice bounding past the car, bursting along with a hideous cracking, and then the ice was overwhelmed by a dark wave of steaming, bubbling slurry, a surge that washed up over the windows of the car. Anne floored the accelerator and held the wheel with a death grip as it bounced in her hands. Mixed with the crashing of the surge wave, she heard Frank's voice shouting, "Go, idiot, go!" And then they were hit hard, and the car slewed off to the left, out of control. Anne hung onto the wheel as it threw her from side to side. Her left ear throbbed with pain. She had hit something with it. She held onto the wheel and kept her foot jamming the accelerator to the floor. The wheels caught on something, and the Rover ground through the water. It poured from right to left, and there was a dull banging against the side of the car. Go! She kept the accelerator floored and turned uphill, bouncing wildly in the driver's seat, all the windows and TV screens liquid madness. Then the water ran under the Rover, and the windows were clear. The Rover's headlights showed rocky ground, falling snow, and ahead, a bare, flat area. Anne kept it floored and jounced wildly toward it, the flood still roaring behind them. When she reached the flat rise, she had to pull her leg and foot away from the accelerator with her hands. The car stopped. They were above the flood, on a narrow bench terrace. It looked like the surge was already receding, but Frank Chalmers was gone. Maya insisted that they return and look for him, and as it was likely that the initial surge would be the largest one, they did so, but it was futile. In the twilight, the headlights cut 50 meters into the snowfall, and in the two intersecting yellow cones and the dark gray world outside them, they saw only the ragged surface of the flood, a pouring sea of flotsam and jetsam without the slightest hint of any regular shape. In fact, it looked like a world in which such shapes were impossible. No one could survive in such madness. Frank was gone, either knocked off the car in its jouncing or swept off it in its brief and nearly fatal encounter with the wave. His final curses still seemed to bubble out of the static on the intercom, out of the roar of the flood. His final imprecation rang in Anne's ears like the judgment it was. Go, idiot, go! It had been her fault. All her fault. Maya was weeping, choking on sobs, doubling over her stomach as if cramping. No! She cried. Frank! Frank! We have to look for him! Then she was crying too hard to speak. Sax went over and dug into the medicine chest and walked over to her and crouched by her side. Here, Maya, do you want a sedative? And she uncoiled and dashed the pills from his hand. No! She screamed. They're my feelings. They're my men. Do you think I'm a coward? Do you think I would want to be a zombie like you? She collapsed into helpless, involuntary, racking sobs. Sax stood over her, blinking, face twisted with a stricken look. Anne found herself cut to the quick by that look. Please, she said. Please, please. She got up from the driver's seat, went back to them, and held Sax briefly by the arm. She crouched to help Nadia and Simon pick Maya up off the floor and get her to bed. Already Maya was quieter, withdrawing from them, her eyes red and her nose running, off in her own grief, one hand clenched in a death grip over Nadia's wrist. Nadia looked down at her with a doctor's detached expression, withdrawn in her own way, murmuring in Russian. Maya, I'm sorry, Anne said. Her throat was cramped. It hurt to talk. It was my fault. I'm sorry. Maya shook her head. It was an accident. Anne couldn't bring herself to say aloud that she had stopped paying attention. The words stuck in her throat, and another spasm of sobs racked Maya, and the chance to speak was gone. Michelle and Cassay took over the driver's seats and started the Rover along the bench again. Not far east of that, the southern canyon wall finally sank down into the surrounding plain, and they were free to move away from the flood, which was in any case following Eos Chasma in a swing to the north, off to a distant reunion with Capri Chasma. Michelle ran across the Hidden Colony's trail, but lost it again, as the trail ducks were often buried in snow. He tried throughout all one day to locate a cache he thought was nearby, but failed. Rather than waste more time, they decided to drive on at full speed, a bit north of east, toward the refuge they had been trying to reach, which Michelle said was in the broken terrain just south of Aurium Chaos. "It's not our main colony anymore," he explained to the others. "It's where we went first, after we left Underhill. But Hiroko wanted to leave for the south, and after a few years we did. She said she didn't like this first shelter because Aurium is a sink, and she thought it might become a lake someday. I thought that was crazy, but I see now that she was right. It looks like Aurium may even be the final drainage for this flood, I don't know. But the refuge is at a higher elevation than we are now, so it will be okay. It may be empty of people, but it will be stocked with supplies. And any port in a storm, yes?" No one had the spirit to reply. On the second day of hard driving, the flood disappeared over the horizon to the north. The roar of it went away soon after. The ground, covered with a meter of dirty snow, no longer trembled underfoot. The world seemed dead, strangely silent and still, shrouded in white. When it wasn't snowing, the sky was still hazy, but it seemed clear enough for them to be spotted from above, so they stopped traveling by day. They moved at night without headlights, across a snowscape that glowed faintly under the stars. Anne drove through these nights. She never told anyone about her moment of inattention at the wheel, and she never even came close to doing it again. She stayed focused with a desperate concentration, biting the inside of her mouth till it bled, oblivious to everything but what lay in the cones of light before her. She usually drove all night, forgetting to wake the next watch's driver, or deciding not to. Frank Chalmers was dead, and it was her fault. Desperately, she wished she could reach back and change things, but it was hopeless. Some mistakes you can never make good. The white landscape was marred by an infinity of stones, each capped with its own cake of snow, and the salt and pepper landscape was such a patchwork that it was hard at night for the eye to make sense of it. Sometimes they seemed to be plowing underground or floating 5 meters over it, a white world. Some nights she understood she was driving a hearse across the body of the deceased. The widows Nadia and Maya in back, and now she knew that Peter was dead, too. Twice she heard Frank calling out to her over the intercom, once asking for her to turn back and help him, the other crying, "Go, idiot, go!" Maya was bearing up well. She was tough, somehow, despite all her moods. Nadia, whom Anne used to think of as a tough one, was silent most of the time. Sax stared at his screen and worked. Michelle tried to talk to his old friends and gave up unhappily when it was clear no one wanted to talk back. Simon watched Anne anxiously as always, with unbearable concern. She couldn't stand it and avoided his gaze. Poor Cassay must have felt like he was trapped in an asylum for the aged insane. It was almost funny to think of it, except that his spirit seemed to be somehow broken. She didn't know why. Perhaps the waste. Perhaps the increasing likelihood that they would not survive. Perhaps simple hunger. There was no way of telling. The young were odd. But he reminded her of Peter, and so she didn't look at him either. The snow made each night glow and pulse. All of it would melt eventually, carve new stream beds, and carry her Mars away. Mars was gone. Michelle sat beside her through the second shifts of the night, looking for signs of the way. "Are we lost?" Maya asked him once, just before dawn. "No, not at all. It's just we're leaving tracks in the snow. I don't know how long they'll last or how visible they are, but if... well, just in case they do last, I want to leave the car and walk the last part of the way. So I want to be precisely sure of where we are before we do that. We've got some standing stones and dolmens erected that will tell us for sure, but I have to find one of those first. They'll show in the horizon, you know. Boulders a bit taller than usual, or columns." "It will be easier to see those by day," Simon said. "True. We'll have a look around tomorrow, and that should do it. We'll be in an area of them. They were designed to help people lost like us. We'll be okay. except that their friends were dead. Her only child was dead, and their world was gone for good. Lying down by the windows at dawn, Anne tried to imagine life in the hidden shelter, underground for years and years. She couldn't do it. Go, idiot, go, damn you! At dawn, Kasey hooted with hoarse triumph. Out there on the northern horizon was a trio of standing stones, a lintel bridging two pillars, as if a single fragment of Stonehenge had flown here. Home was that way, said Kasey. But first they would wait through the day. Michelle was becoming extremely cautious about being seen from satellites and wanted to continue on by night. They settled down to get some sleep. Anne couldn't sleep. She found herself energized by a new resolve. When the rest were out cold, Michelle snoring happily, all of them asleep for the first time in about 50 hours, she tugged into her walker and tiptoed into the lock. She looked back and surveyed them, a hungry, ragged lot. Nadia's crippled hand stuck out from her side. Getting out the lock made some unavoidable noise, but everyone was used to sleeping through noise, and the whirs and clicks of the life support system partially covered her exit. She got out without waking anyone. The planet's basal chill. She shuddered in it and set off west, walking in the rover's tracks so she couldn't be followed. The sun was cutting through the mist. Snow was falling again, tinted pink in shafts of sunlight. She trudged along until it came on a low drumlin ridge with its steep side clear of snow. She could traverse along the bare rock without leaving tracks. She did so until she got tired. It was really cold out, the sun falling straight down in tiny flakes, probably accreted around sand grains. At the end of the drumlin was a fat, low boulder. She sat in its lee. She turned off her walker's heating unit and covered the blinking alarm light on her wrist pad with a clump of snow. It got colder fast. The sky was an opaque gray now, tinged with faint pink. Snow fell out of the pinkness onto her faceplate. She had just stopped shivering and was getting comfortably chill when a boot kicked her hard in the helmet and she was dragged up to her knees with her head ringing. A suited figure banged its faceplate into hers hard. Then hands with a vice's grip took her by the shoulders and flung her down to the ground. Hey! She cried weakly. She was yanked by her shoulders to her feet, and her left arm was pulled back and held up high behind her back. Her assailant worked at her wrist pad and then shoved her painfully forward, her arm still held high. She couldn't fall without breaking her arm. She could feel the diamond pattern of her suit's heating elements begin to flare against her skin, burning their pattern into her. Every few steps, she was slapped hard in the helmet. The figure marched her right back to their own rover, which astonished her. She was shoved into the lock, and the figure tumbled in after her, and closed and pumped the chamber, and tore off her helmet and then his, and to her utter amazement, it was her Simon, purple-faced and shouting at her, striking her still, his face soaking wet with tears. This, her Simon, the quiet one, now yelling at her, "Why? Why? Damn you, you always do this. It's always just you, 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 off in your own world. You are so selfish." Voice rising to a final painful shriek, her Simon, who never said anything, never raised his voice, never spoke more than a word, now striking her and shrieking in her face, literally spitting, gasping with fury, and suddenly it made her mad. Why not before? Why not when she had needed someone with some life in him? Why had it taken this to rouse him? She punched him right in the chest, hard, and he fell back. "Leave me alone!" she shouted. "Leave me alone!" And then the anguish shuddered through her, the chilled shiver of Martian death. "Why didn't you leave me alone?" He regained his balance, lunged forward and seized her by both shoulders, shook her. She had never noticed how powerful his hands were. "Because!" he shouted, and paused to lick his lips and catch his breath. "Because..." and his eyes bugged out, and his face darkened even further, as if a thousand sentences had all jammed in his throat at once. This, her mild Simon. And then he gave up on saying it, and roared, and shook her in his arms, shouting, "Because! Because! Because!" Snow fell. Though it was early morning, it was dim. Wind whipped across the chaos, swirling the spindrift over the shattered land. Boulders as big as city blocks lay jumbled against each other, and the landscape was broken in a million little cliffs, holes, mesas, ridges, peaks. Also many peculiar spikes and towers and balancing rocks held in place by Kami alone. All the steep or vertical stone in this chaotic terrain was still black, while flatter areas were now white with snow, so that the landscape was a densely variegated black and white, all swirling in and out of visibility as billows and veils of snow gusted by. Then the snow stopped, the wind died. The black verticals and white horizontals gave the world a definition it didn't usually have. In the overcast, there were no shadows, and the landscape glowed as if light were pouring up through the snow onto the bottoms of the dusky, low clouds. Everything was sharp-edged and distinct, as if captured in glass. Over the horizon appeared moving figures. One by one they appeared, until there were seven of them in a ragged line. They moved slowly, their shoulders slumped, their helmets bent forward. They moved as if they had no destination. The two in front looked up from time to time, but they never paused or pointed the way. The western clouds gleamed like mother of pearl, the only sign on that dull day that the sun was lowering. The figures walked up a long ridge that emerged from the blasted landscape. From the upper slopes of the ridge, one could see a long way in every direction. It took a long time for the figures to climb the ridge. Finally, they approached a peak, a bouldery knob where the ridge began to descend again. At the summit of the knob was a curious thing, a big, flat-bottomed boulder standing high in the air, balanced on six slender stone pillars. The seven figures approached this megalith. They stopped and regarded it for a time under the dark, bruised clouds. Then they stepped between the pillars and under the boulder. It stood well over them, a massive roof. The circular floor beneath it was flat, made of cut, polished stone. One of the figures walked to a far column and touched it with a finger. The others looked out at the motionless, snowy chaos. A trap door slid open in the floor. The figures went to it, and one by one stepped down into the ridge. When they were gone, the six slender columns began to sink into the floor, and the great dolmen that they held aloft descended on them, until the columns disappeared and the great rock rested on the ridge, returned to its ancient existence as an impressive peak boulder. Beyond the clouds, the sun had set, and the light leaked out of the empty land. It was Maya who kept them going. Maya who drove them into heading south. The refuge under the dolmen was just that. A sequence of small caves in the ridge, stocked with emergency rations and gas supplies, but otherwise empty. After a few days to rest and catch up on sleep and food, Maya began to complain. It was no way to live, she said. It was no more than a kind of death in life. Where were all the others? Where was Hiroko? Michelle and Kasei explained again that the hidden colony was in the south, that they had moved down there long ago. All right, Maya said. Then we will go south, too. There were other boulder cars in the refuge's garage. They could caravan down by night, she said, and out of the canyons they would be safe. The refuge was no longer self-sustaining, in any case. Its supplies were large but limited, so they would have to go sooner or later. Best to go while the dust storm would still provide some cover for the trip. Best to go. So she drove the tired little group to action. They loaded two cars and took off again, south across the great rumpled plains of Margaritifer Sinus. Free from the restrictions of Marineris, they made hundreds of kilometers per night and slept through the days. And in a nearly speechless journey of several days, they passed between Argyre and Hellas, through the endless crater land of the southern highlands. It began to seem that they had never done anything but drive onward in their little cars, that the journey would last forever. But then one night they drove onto the layered terrain of the polar region, and near dawn the horizon ahead gleamed, and then became a dim white bar, which thickened and thickened as they proceeded, until it was a white cliff standing before them. The southern polar cap, evidently. Michel and Cassay took over the two driver's seats and conferred over the intercom in low voices. They drove on until they reached the white cliff, and they continued to drive straight at it, until they were on frozen, crusted sand that was under the bulk of the ice. The cliff was an enormous overhang, like a wave stopped in the moment it was about to crash onto a beach. There was a tunnel cut into the ice at the bottom of the cliff, and a figure in a walker appeared and directed the two rovers into it. The tunnel led them straight into the ice for what must have been a kilometer at least. The tunnel was wide enough for two or three rovers and had a low ceiling. The ice around them was a pure white dry ice, only lightly streaked by stratification. They passed through two locks filling the tunnel, and in the third lock Michel and Cassay stopped the rovers and opened their locks and climbed down. Maya, Nadia, Sax, Simon, and Anne followed them out of the cars. They passed through a locked door and walked down the tunnel in silence. Then the tunnel opened up, and they all stopped, stilled by the sight that met them. Overhead was an enormous dome of gleaming white ice. They stood under it as if under a giant overturned bowl. The dome was several kilometers in diameter and at least a kilometer high, maybe more. It rose swiftly from the perimeters and then bowled gently across the center. The light was diffuse but fairly strong, as if on a cloudy day, and it seemed to come from the white dome itself, which gleamed. The ground under the dome was gently rolling reddish sand, grassy in the hollows, with frequent stands of tall bamboo and gnarled pine. There were some small hillocks to the right, and clustered in these hills was a little village, one- and two-story houses painted white and blue, interspersed with large trees which had bamboo rooms and staircases set in their thick branches. Michel and Cassay were walking toward this village, and the woman who had guided their cars into the tunnel lock was running ahead, shouting, "They're here! They're here!" Under the other side of the dome, there was a lake of faintly steaming open water, its surface a white sheen lined by waves that broke on the near shore. On the far shore stood the blue bulk of a rickover, its reflection a smear of blue across the white water. Gusts of cold, damp wind nipped at their ears. Michel came back and retrieved his old friends, who were standing like statues. "Come on, it's cold out," he said with a smile. "There's a water ice layer stuck to the dome, so we have to keep the air below freezing all the time." People were spilling out of the village, calling out. Down by the little lake, a young man appeared sprinting toward them, gazelling over the dunes in great leaps. Even after all their years on Mars, such a flying run still looked dreamlike to the first hundred. And it took a while before Simon clutched Anne by the arm and cried, "That's Peter! That's Peter!" "Peter," she said. And then they were in a crush of people, many of them young folk and children, strangers, but with familiar faces everywhere making their way to the fore. Hiroko and Iwao, Raoul, Raya, Jean, Peter crashing in to hug Anne and Simon. And there were Vlad and Ursula and Marina and several others from the Acheron group, all clustered around them, reaching to touch them. "What is this place?" Maya cried. "This is home," Hiroko said. "This is where we start again."
The End. You've been listening to Red Mars by Kim Stanley Robinson, narrated by Richard Ferrone.